We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to the first hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be spending some time talking about international law and perhaps touching on a number of things, including international humanitarian, human rights, possibly refugee law, all things that are of interest to the guest that we have here in the first part of the program. She's Elizabeth Anderson, and she's the Executive Director and Executive Vice President of the American Society of International Law. She's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois at an event here taking place at the law school, in part to talk with students about possibility of careers in international law and also to talk about her interest. And we're glad she could come and spend a little bit of time with us. Let me tell you just a little bit more about her. She joined the Society in 1995, became its executive director in 2006. She also served as executive director of the American Bar Association's Central European and Eurasian Law Initiative. She also served as executive director of Human Rights Watch Europe and Central Asia Division, and also she served as a legal assistant to one of the judges at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, also clerked with Kimba Wood of the U.S. District Court of the Southern District of New York. And she's here with us in studio and would be happy to take questions. They are welcome here at the usual numbers, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. We're very happy at ASIL to have the University of Illinois School of Law as an academic partner, and it's a pleasure both for me and for the Society's president, Lucy Reed, to be here today.
You want to talk just a little bit about the American Society of International Law?
Sure. We have been around for 104 years. Back in 1906, there was a group of international lawyers, practitioners, and academics in primarily in the Washington area, led by then Secretary of State Elihu Root, who thought it was very important that international law be at the center of U.S. foreign policy and that there be a non-governmental organization, a society that would convene people to talk about international law, educate people about international law, and think hard about how it could inform U.S. international relations. So they formed the society, and we have ever since been promoting greater understanding and use of international law. That's our mission.
I don't know if this is too large and abstract a kind of a question to start out with, but it seems to me that you know, one of the realities of geopolitics is that nations have their interests. And one of the chief interests I think probably any nation has is national sovereignty. And frequently that idea conflicts with the idea that we have of international law. And in fact, I suppose some people might ask this question, well, how is it that we actually think that there is such a thing as international law? How can there be such a thing as international law?
Well, international law is first and foremost, a function of national sovereignty. It's an expression of national sovereignty. And I think this is sometimes lost in current debates about international law here in the United States. But what happens in most areas of international law is that national sovereigns decide that they can't solve some global problem by themselves and enter into a contract, an agreement, a treaty with other sovereigns to work together to solve that problem, very much like private actors enter into agreements in our day-to-day lives. And again, it is not that international law of that nature is somehow eroding national sovereignty. It is an expression of that sovereignty. It is, in fact, one of the privileges of a sovereign to enter into an agreement on behalf of its people with the sovereign of another state. So that is, I think, something of a misunderstanding about international law. And, that misunderstanding comes from the fact that increasingly we are also thinking of international law as sometimes limiting the authority of sovereigns. And that is particularly the case in the human rights field. Mm-hmm. And that idea stems from the fact that sovereignty is not a blank check. It is increasingly in our contemporary thinking, certainly since World War II, there's an understanding that, yes, sovereignty brings with it great privileges to any government anywhere in the world, but, as I say, not a blank check to treat your people without regard for international norms. And so the body of international human rights law has developed really since World War II, and the United States was at the forefront in the aftermath of World War II in articulating and defining that law to curb abuses. Hmm. And that body of international human rights law was used, has been used very effectively to censor the abuses of many governments, and the U.S. has been involved in enforcing that law. And it was very important. International human rights law was very important in eroding the authority of the Soviet Union, for example, during the Cold War. That was a critical tool of the United States in that dynamic to be able to criticize the Soviet Union and communist bloc states for their abuses of human rights law. So it is an important tool in U.S. foreign relations. We sometimes struggle when it is turned on us here in the United States, but that's part of the bargain. Hmm.
So, well, if it is the case that part of the function of international law simply is to provide a framework for states to resolve their differences, and maybe the aspect that gets more attention is issues of human rights, is in fact most of the things that happen within international law are relatively non-controversial, not the kind of things that are going to make headlines?
I think so. And I think that's a challenge to my organization to raise awareness of all the ways in which international law works for us and helps us in our daily lives. The very fresh, beautiful strawberries that I enjoyed at breakfast at the law school this morning are a function of international trade agreements. I'm sure there are no strawberries growing in the fields of Illinois this time of year. And the fact that our cell phones can work the world over, we can travel across borders with relative ease, all a function of international agreements that help us in our daily lives. In fact, ASIL has on its website an interesting resource called 100 Ways. We put it together for our centennial, 100 Ways International Law Shapes Our Lives, and illustrates all of the things that we tend to take for granted that are a function of international law.
Well, because going back, though, to the question, say we're talking about human rights, because if another sort of function of international law is also then to provide some sort of framework for groups of nations to try to hold other nations to some sort of generally agreed set of principles, how then it seems that we still have the issue of national sovereignty when one nation, it could be that some grouping of other nations, and usually this happens under the auspices of the United Nations, says, well, you know, we have some real concerns about how you're treating your citizens. When the government of that nation says, well, tough, there are citizens and it's our business, how do you make the argument that says that there actually is there is standing, that is the other countries have some sort of standing so that they can make the claim that they have something to say about how another country treats its citizens within the borders of that country?
Mm-hmm. Well, the primary basis for that standing is often international agreements that both the critical countries and the target of their criticism have entered into, have signed, for example, and there are certain of these agreements that are universally subscribe to, or almost universally subscribe to, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, for example. The Geneva Conventions, I think, have universal ratifications at this point. And some principles of international law that are so fundamental and widely respected that they have become considered an element of customary international law binding on all states. The prohibition against torture, for example, is an example of that. Genocide, another example. So these, there's no argument really about the standing of any state to hold others accountable for these. Now, there is a separate question of, apart from standing, is effectiveness of that criticism. And some critics of international law suggest that there's no law there because we don't have the means of enforcement. But in fact, it's not as clean a system of enforcement as we have, for example, in our domestic sphere, where you've got police and prosecutors and courts and a pretty well-defined process. In the international sphere, it's a little bit more complex. Some means of enforcement are in political bodies, the UN, the General Assembly, the Security Council have the authority to pass resolutions, impose sanctions. And then there are also international judicial bodies. So under certain conventions, the Genocide Convention, for example, there is jurisdiction before the World Court, the International Court of Justice in The Hague. One country can take another country to court there. And then there are a means for individuals before some judicial bodies to seek redress. So there are both global UN committees set up to oversee the implementation of human rights. And in some cases, individuals can take cases to those bodies. There are regional courts, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the European Court of Human Rights. There's a new African Court of Human Rights that's being set up where individuals can also take cases. And so it's not as straightforward as it is in the domestic sphere, but there are, depending on the violation and the parties and the situation, there are means of enforcement that can be quite effective.
Well, then, and I have a couple of callers here we get to just a moment here. But it seems that at the end of the day, you still have a problem in that there are some countries, and it seems that on the one hand, there are some countries that are big enough, or there are some countries small enough, that is, the big enough countries exercise a lot of political influence. And perhaps on the other end, the smaller countries, maybe it's simply that they just don't care. That it becomes very difficult to exercise any sort of influence on those governments and how they conduct themselves.
Well, it's challenging, certainly, but I have real hope that time is certainly on the side of enforcement of international human rights norms. That's what history teaches us, certainly, and it. In some cases, it rests with civil society, with individual citizens in the big countries, for example, to embrace these norms and hold their own sovereigns accountable. In other cases, it's, as I say, a matter of time. I started my career in international human rights at the War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and that was the first war crimes trial to be held internationally since Nuremberg. And it was a kind of an amazing set of developments that I think none of the various actors in the conflict in the former Yugoslavia could have dreamt that when they unleashed those forces of criminality and genocide in that part of the world, that they would actually be called to account for it. And so, as I say, that experience and the experience in many other contexts, Cambodia, 30 years after the killing fields, we are now seeing accountability. It may take time, but I'm pretty confident that there will be such accountability.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Elizabeth Anderson. She's the Executive Director and Executive Vice President of the American Society of International Law. Been around since 1906, the country's leading institution for advancing the study and the use of international law. She's here visiting the campus for an event at the law school where she's spending time talking with law students about international law and careers in that area. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here. We'll start out with someone in Champaign and line one right here. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to take a contrarian position. First, I think it's a misnomer to call it international law, despite the fact that diplomats and lawyers like to use that, and certainly UN officials, and so do and other international body officials. Law comes from the people. The people have not created international body. International bodies have been created by political entities called nation states. You could argue about sovereignty issues, but really, there is no sovereign world state, and hopefully there will not be. So I think to compare the two is really a product of international relations, it's a product of diplomatic relations, and it's a product of power politics, so that you have international laws that are really a product of the more powerful states or the states who are dominant coming together to make agreements and trying to enforce those on others. Certainly the whole idea of law needs to be looked at. Certainly, at least in the American context, law comes from the people. It doesn't come from agreements made between governing bodies trying to superimpose it upon us. You could talk about it in terms of the Constitution. Certainly, I mean, you're talking about human rights norms, but I don't see that enforced on, let's say, more powerful countries such as China, whether in the issues of Tibet, the issues of the Uyghurs. So really, it's a product of convenience. It's a product that the more powerful states seem to impose on those less powerful. The more politically correct states impose on those who they disagree with. Otherwise, it's a misnomer to use the word law. Instead, call it political treaties, call it political agreements, call it what you will. But it mixes us up when we compare it with law as something that we the people create a nation, we the people have natural rights that are a product of us being people, not a product of political entities called nation states coming to agreements of.
All right. Well, your caller raises some interesting points. You want to talk about that?
Sure. I think that's a very useful contribution, and I think you're absolutely right that there are some differences in the way that law is developed at the international level, but I would take issue with the idea that it is not at all accountable or a product of the people. What happens, at least in the United States and in democratic countries, is that the lawmaking is delegated by the people to the federal government. And that's very much in the same way that we delegate lawmaking in other areas to Congress and to the president. We do so similarly in the international sphere, and we have, of course, in our Constitution, perhaps because the founders had some of this anxiety that you express about delegating too much to folks in Washington. There is in the Constitution, of course, the requirement that there be two-thirds of the Senate supportive of a treaty that the United States enters into before it is it becomes binding on the United States. And that's a useful check against the kinds of abuses that you're warning about. And I think has worked well for the United States. The U.S. is often slow to ratify international agreements because of this, because citizens in the United States may express concern about international agreements to their congressmen and women. And so as a result, the senators don't ratify the treaty. And so we have a pretty good check against abuse in this area. I'd frankly be more concerned about international law agreements that are entered into by countries that are not democratically elected. But I think we have a pretty good check and balance on that in the United States.
I have some other calls I want to get on to, and I hope the caller will forgive me. I guess I'm expecting there would be people who want to press the point further about the fact that there are some governments in the United States, they would say was one of them, that that does some picking and choosing what things they're going to, what sort of international norms they're going to abide by and which they aren't. You know, depending on your orientation, you might find a particular administration you're going to want to jump on. Overall, what would you say about the commitment of the United States to international, to these kinds of international principles?
It's hard to generalize. I think we do some picking and choosing, and it is indeed the sovereign right of the United States government to pick and choose. So there was, for example, a record number of treaties. This is not widely known. Record number of treaties in the last year of the Bush administration that the U.S. Ratified. I think 90 treaties in the last Congress were ratified by Congress and under the Bush administration. And they are it illustrates the areas of law where we're quite comfortable, and it serves our interests unequivocally to enter into such agreements. So they were agreements on mutual legal assistance in criminal matters, extradition treaties enabling us to cooperate with law enforcement in other countries, in particular in the war on terror. It's very important. They were international tax treaties, very important for the ability of businesses and individuals to travel and do business in different countries and not have their tax situation complicated. So in those kinds of areas, we are very much engaged in supportive of the development of the international system in lots of other areas as well, trade, for example. There are some areas, though, that have been more difficult for the U.S. The U.S. has been slower to engage. And this is, as you suggest, a difficult political question, a matter of what is in U.S. interests. And I think we see policy change from administration to administration and views of the American people reflected in that. I think that the better, and I should say that this is a personal view, not necessarily the view of the American Society of International Law, which doesn't take positions on matters of policy. But I think generally we are better served by an approach that is one of engagement, of joining these international treaties, these international bodies, and getting a seat at the table and arguing our position from that seat of relative authority rather than taking shots at something from outside. An example that we're facing right now in the development of law is in the regulation of the Arctic. And the Arctic is melting. And there are are a whole bunch of issues emerging as a result of that about who can use potential open water in the Arctic, who can explore for natural resources in the Arctic that may become accessible. And that is all regulated by an international treaty. Currently, it's the Law of the Sea Convention. And the U.S. is the only one of the countries that has land bordering on the Arctic, who potentially has a stake in what's under the ice, that is not a party to the Law of the Sea Convention. So you've got the Russians and the Canadians and others who are using the Law of the Sea Convention and the forum of the Law of the Sea to argue and advance their case on their claims for the Arctic region, and the U.S. is not at the table. So that is an example of why we may not agree with everything in a convention or that's done by a body, but we ought to be at the table and working to fix that if that's the case.
At the midpoint here, our guest is Elizabeth Anderson. She's the Executive Director and Executive Vice President of the American Society of International Law. She's here visiting the campus for the Society's Midwest Conference. One of the sponsors is the U of I College of Law. She's here to, among other things, talk with law students about international law careers, and she's here spending a little time with us. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go on to another caller here, Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hi. If I'd asked your question host, David, I would have been insisting on a follow-up, I think, because I think that the forma of law that was referred to, not the content, but the idea I'm trying to get at is I thought you were asking a completely different question. What is the U.S., how would you rate the U.S. commitment to international law in the sense of the spirit of law and justice? And it frustrates me that we hear that international law was a tool to, you know, help bring down the Soviet Union, and we talked about their crimes, but contemporaneous with that unraveling of the Soviet Union were a genocide in Guatemala, which doesn't get mentioned as being needing adjudication. It seems to me that we have a good example of the lack of commitment to international law in the response to the Goldstone report about the attack on Gaza. It's a completely utilitarian view. The envoy, legal envoy to Israel says that we will help you deal with the fallout from this unfortunate dilemma that you have. You mentioned that torture is a well adjudicated and respected sort of idea in international law. Following the Friday assessment of John Yoo, that he was just incorrect and not in any way culpable when he says that the president has the right to order burning down of killing everyone in a village if it's national security. So I just, I'm totally frustrated with I guess it's, you know, but one parting shot, if I might, and I'll listen off the air, I guess, since the lines are piling up. A Dutch jurist gave a critical report on the proceedings that you were involved with. I don't have the reference in front of me, but he basically blasted the trial of in the aftermath of the Yugoslavian unraveling, and we rarely hear it. It wasn't commented much contemporaneously at the time, I'm getting apoplectic, and I'd like for you to respond to some of that, if you would. Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
I think it's a good point, and this applies to international law. It applies to any system of law, domestic law, that when law is abused, or and then there is no response, or the response is considered to be one-sided or unfair, then that undermines the rule of law. It undermines the authority of law. And so to the extent that that there is a perception of that kind of one-sidedness in international law, then I think it's a challenge to civil society. It's a challenge to citizens to mobilize for it for their governments to apply that law in a more even-handed and fair way. And so I guess my response to the caller would be to encourage him to pursue this with our leaders in Washington and through the media, as you are doing effectively here, to insist that our government take what is ultimately a political decision to hold itself to the very same standard that it holds others to.
All right, let's go on. We'll see what other callers have to say. Go to somebody here on line number four on a cell phone, I think. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a law student, who has raised a very interesting issue for his class project in my class, and wanted to get your take on it. He's interested in patent law and has raised the issue of traditional knowledge and the concept that large pharmaceutical companies and others are taking advantage of indigenous folks when they develop a medicinal, come up with a medicine with a native species. And I'm just interested to know if your organization has looked into this traditional knowledge issue or if you've heard about it. So thank you very much. I'll take my answer off the air.
I do know that it's an issue that's out there. I think it's a great topic. I don't myself know a lot about it, but we within ASIL have an interest group on the rights of indigenous peoples, and I think there are probably experts within that group that could direct you or direct your student, and I'd be happy to make that connection if you reach out to me. My email is on our website.
All right. Well, other calls and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Elizabeth Anderson. She's Executive Director and Executive Vice President of the American Society of International Law. And we will continue and next talk with someone in Urbana, line 3.
Oh,
hello.
Hi, how are you?
Yes.
As for law, there, like when you talk about business law, this is treaties between countries for exchanging goods and stuff. Those are probably more directed by the economically powerful. But when you go back to when you were talking about Cambodia, I was in Vietnam 40 years ago, spent a lot of time along the Cambodian border, and I would say, excuse me, it's like hallucinatory to say that the 4 or 5 or 10 people they're going to try, Pol Pot died, you know, basically in a little hut somewhere. They're not going to, there's no justice for those people who died. And I'd like to talk to you about law and then application of law. You can have all the laws you want, but if you don't apply them, they're irrelevant. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, I think you're right. And maybe thinking about Cambodia, it's a question, is a glass half full, glass half empty? Certainly justice, more immediate justice would have satisfied more people sooner. But I would suggest that it's important that we have it ultimately. And I have not been to Cambodia, but from those who have been there recently and following closely and in person the trials there, report that it is not only holding those handful of individuals accountable and bringing some measure of justice to their personal victims, but it's having a transformative effect on the culture and on the historical understanding of what happened. And that can be very important, not only for the immediate victims, but in the long-term development of a culture of rule of law and to ensure us to assure us that this would not happen again, that that those who might perpetrate these kinds of crimes know that there will be accountability eventually, and that is an important deterrent effect.
Well, I suppose one could ask the same question about the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. I don't know how many people actually have appeared there and been charged. Some high-profile individuals, their trials got a lot of attention. Slobodan Milosevic, who ended up dying before it was finished. Radovan Karadzic, who was for a long time one of the most wanted, who is there now in trials in progress. And then there's one more guy, Ratko Mladic, who's still at large that they would like to have there. So some number of individuals have been charged and tried. But one might also ask that same question. There were a lot of other people who were involved in this at a much lower level. So that if you do charge the people who were in leadership positions, you know, say even if you had 100 or 200 people, and that they're held accountable, how far does that go towards achieving some kind of justice?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're, I think, over the course of the last two decades, with the experience of the Yugoslav Tribunal and the Rwanda Tribunal and the Sierra Leone Tribunal in Cambodia and now the International Criminal Court, we are refining these institutions of accountability and learning from them. And a caller earlier noted a critical account in the Dutch circles of the Yugoslav Tribunal, and there have been many, and some of those criticisms have been well-founded and people have learned. I think we're getting better and better at this. One of the things that we've learned is the importance, and this is actually written into the statute of the International Criminal Court, at the U.S. government's insistence, that we've learned the importance of this idea used in these contexts of complementarity, that there would be complementary proceedings at the international level and then also at the national level. And the idea, in particular as it's reflected in the statute of the International Criminal Court, is that these kinds of accountability processes are, when possible, are best carried out at the national level. That they're closer to the evidence, they're closer to the victims, they're closer to the perpetrators. It will have a more immediate impact on the culture locally to have a trial in Rwanda or Bosnia than in The Hague in a different language. So the idea of complementarity is we have some proceedings, most of the proceedings, carried out, if at all possible, at the national level, and then only when it's necessary for security reasons or because of the domestic political situation or the willingness of the domestic authorities to pursue accountability. Only when necessary do you pursue accountability at the international level. And that's really – it was not the design of the Yugoslav Tribunal in the first instance, but it's the way it's played out. So we've had, I think, 130, 140 indictees tried in The Hague at the Yugoslav Tribunal. As you point, there are one or two remain at large, but most of those indicted have been held accountable there. But simultaneously, in Bosnia, in Croatia, and in Serbia, we've had hundreds of domestic war crimes trials. And that has, A, brought justice to a larger number of victims. It has had that transformative effect on the local culture. It has helped build the judicial capacity of those countries going forward. So a lot of prosecutors and judges and investigators have been trained by the international community to carry out these trials in Bosnia and Serbia. And after their war crimes business is done in the coming years, that cadre of now well-experienced judicial officers will remain and help ensure the rule of law going forward.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Elizabeth Anderson. She's Executive Director, Executive Vice President of the American Society of International Law. And by the way, if you're interested in learning more about the society, some of the issues that they're involved in, their website is kind of what you would expect, asil.org. So you can go there. And we have some other callers. Next is line number one, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Some of the previous callers have indicated some suspicion about the effectiveness of international law. I think that it's been undermined by the doubt and cynicism created by instances such as the former vice president of the United States stating that he's a big supporter of waterboarding, and that the legal advice that that administration received by persons such as John Yoo and Jay Bybee, who is now assisting judge, and Stephen Bradbury, have all been just found to be guilty of nothing more than poor judgment on behalf of the current administration. And the current administration position seems to be that any persons who were following that advice cannot be held accountable for any actions that they took as a result of abiding by the advice that they received at that time. I think that most people of good faith would understand that international law requires the trust and confidence of the citizens, not just of the nations, but of the world, who are relying on these entities, such as the first caller talked about, that have been created through our elected officials, and that when, as the highest elected officials in the world, which I think the former vice president of the United States certainly would be considered one of those, express a contempt for international law as well as domestic law, and we're not seeing any meaningful accountability follow any of these gross statements. I think that's what is leading to a breakdown of the international law, and a profound apathy on the part of people. As you were saying, we want people to be involved in expressing themselves and their concern over these issues, so that we can bolster the confidence and trust that people have in the laws, not of only of their own country, but of the countries of the world agreeing on certain, as you said, established norms. And I think I've talked long enough now. If you could respond to some of that, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, I'm not in a position to take a position specifically on the report that just came out of the Department of Justice on Friday and the culpability of any individuals who may have rendered legal advice regarding the war on terror. But I do but speaking more generally about strategies for enforcing international law, I guess I, drawing on my own experience as spending better part of a decade as a human rights lawyer working not on the United States but on other countries and other parts of the world, it's not – and this is a difference between international law and domestic law, I think, and advocacy – is it's not always a straight line where you file a complaint and a bring a case and have it adjudicated and see justice meted out. It's sometimes a much more complex, multifaceted enforcement process to get to implementation or accountability. And it's one of the things that makes it an interesting field is it requires a fair amount of creativity, using not just traditional adjudication and courts, but, for example, the court of public opinion, the media, raising awareness. And we have today more vehicles with the web for doing that than we have in the past. It's making appeals not only through our own domestic bodies, but also through international bodies. So, for example, I think in the next year or so, the United States will be reporting again its annual or its regular report to the UN Convention on the UN Convention Against Torture and its efforts to implement that convention. It has to make a report to the UN Committee Against Torture, and then that committee will review the U.S. record. Well, that is a moment when there will be international attention and quote-unquote adjudication of U.S. compliance with its obligations under the Torture Convention. Seems to me, to the extent that there are issues one might have with U.S. implementation of its obligation under the Convention Against Torture, including its obligation to investigate allegations of torture, that that might be a forum where that case could be made. And civil society has a place there, has a role to file reports with that body, be present at those hearings, raise awareness of its findings in the United States. And it's those kinds of activities that I think are going to have to be the front in accountability for these on these issues in the immediate future. And over time, there may be other fora that open up as well.
Well, and this certainly doesn't surprise me that we've heard from a lot of people who feel a lot of frustration and maybe outright anger over the idea that we have some set of principles when it comes to international law and things like human rights, but that they would say they're extremely disappointed at the record of the United States in adhering to those principles. For you, I mean, not speaking as the, you know, the executive director of the American Society of International Law, but for you personally, as somebody who has worked in this field, do you share that frustration?
Personally, I have at times over the last since in particular the last decade since 9/11 had that frustration. But I recognize that this is international law and international human rights law is requires a social commitment, and it requires a social struggle to develop a compact and agreement that and it is put under stress in circumstances like 9/11 and the conflict with Al-Qaeda, because there are very real security concerns that the U.S. is grappling with and trying to balance with its commitments to international human rights norms. Now, I think the better argument is that, in fact, in most cases, if not all, those security interests are served ultimately, maybe not in the moment, but ultimately by a firm commitment to international law. But that's it takes something of a leap of faith, and that is a challenging discussion for our country to be in. I think we've been in it. I think it was part of our last presidential election, and it is ongoing as we struggle with questions about how to close Guantanamo, what to do with the detainees that are held there. One very positive note that I take great comfort in and I see as progress for international law is what seems to be a very firm commitment on the part of this administration, the Obama administration, to forego methods of torture. Enhanced interrogation in its efforts to combat terrorism going forward. And I think that that is a very significant development and a success for international law, international human rights law.
We have one more caller in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
I'll try to keep it short, David. The occurs to me with international law, human rights, and all the other things that are supposedly in place, and George Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld, an act of Congress, and the U.S. courts got immunity from their vile acts in both Iraq and now Afghanistan, and it appears to me that Mr. Obama is playing into that same paradigm. And how is that possible to do today? 25 people were killed, innocents, in Afghanistan with drones. Who sets those off? Who then must be responsible for the death of innocent people? Well, we can't just call those casualties of war, because war, however it is perpetrated and acted out on by the West, particularly in the last 1,000 years, those things have got to be addressed. We can't continue to give immunity to people who perpetrate the crimes and then stand as not responsible for their actions. And those places are 10,000 miles away from the U.S. And last thing, terrorism, this is an old phrase I heard on this show about 5 years ago. I think a man was Asian of some sort, and put down. I mean, we are all brothers and sisters, but the thing is, he said, one man's terrorist, is another man's hero. Thank you.
Well, I'm not familiar with the particular incident that you described today in Afghanistan and can't really comment on that specifically. I think generally the U.S. government does and the U.S. military does have systems in place, does take very seriously. In fact, I think a great ally in the enforcement of the Geneva Conventions generally has been the U.S. military, because it's the soldiers, the U.S. soldiers, who recognize that they benefit from those Geneva Conventions when they're the ones who are prisoners of war. And so they do take those obligations very seriously and do have in place mechanisms for investigation of any alleged violations. And I anticipate that to the extent there were any, they will be investigated.
We're at the point where we essentially have to finish. And the caller's taking the opportunity to criticize the government, which is certainly fine. And you're not here to defend it. But what I guess I wonder, just to finish up with it, how it is that you manage to be long-term optimistic, given the fact that there's so much of a disconnect between kind of how we would like things to function and how they do.
Well, I think perhaps it's something in my nature. Perhaps it's the fact that I studied history before law. And I do see that there is long-term dramatic progress, things that we just could not have imagined even 10 years ago now are in place, established institutions, mechanisms for enforcement and development of law. And we don't always get it right, but we keep working at it. And I think it's in the long term, we're on a march of progress in this area. And I think with the good input of some of the folks that have been calling in today, we can make even more progress.
Well, we're going to have to stop there because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Elizabeth Anderson, is Executive Director and Executive Vice President of the American Society of International Law. If you're interested in finding out about the society, their website is www.asil.org. She's here visiting the campus for the Midwest Conference of the Society, partly sponsored by the University of Illinois College of Law. Thanks very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.